Okay, I'm going to open today's meeting of the House Subcommittee on Higher Education. Welcome to all of you. We have been having a series of sort of themed hearings for the last couple of weeks on various aspects of the higher education world. Today we're going to have public hearings on five bills, and the theme that unites them all is yet to be determined. So we'll maybe have a little quiz at the end and figure out what the theme of today is. But what we're going to do is hear three of them first as a group, and then we'll move on to the other two. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2728, House Bills 2729, and House Bills 2731. And I would call up Representative Reed, who is sort of a sub-theme of these three, since he sponsored them all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Rep. Reed, if you just hold on a sec, I'm going to ask our administrator to give us an introduction to these three bills first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2728 expands the current statute to allow taxpayers to make direct deposit contributions or of all or a portion of income tax refunds into Oregon 529 College Savings Network account. Applies to income tax refunds payable to taxpayers for tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2011, and it takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. House Bill 2729 allows counties to designate educational development zones and permits graduate of Oregon post-secondary institutions to defer payment of property taxes on newly purchased homes, instructs the Director of Oregon Business Development Department to adopt rules guiding counties in designating these zones, and establishes eligibility criteria, requires the Director of the Department of Revenue to adopt rules establishing terms and procedures for claiming tax deferral, applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2012, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. House Bill 2731 expands the current statute to establish credit against personal income tax for, property tax for amounts paid by eligible taxpayers who paid for and received instruction leading to a GREE or recognized certificate from Oregon post-secondary institutions, establishes requirements for receiving tax credit, applies to amounts paid in tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2013 and before January 1st, 2022. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Anna. And actually, before we begin, I see some guests here today who seem to be visual statements for something. Who do we have as guests today? Could you tell us? Do they have to come over?
Oh, we have Michael Parker.
That's right. I'm sorry. Yes.
We're here from Lindbergh Community College to testify on
30, 40. Okay, excellent. Thank you.
I'm the chair of the program, and these are students, and also have here the Senator, former food service manager.
Great. I look forward to hearing from you. Great. Okay, sorry, Rep. Reed.
No
problem. Proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair Dembo, Chair Johnson, Vice Chairs, and all the other empty chairs. Appreciate your willingness to hear these bills, and happy to be associated with a sub-theme. Perhaps the game show can continue later on when we all submit suggestions for what the theme might be, and if it's good food, that'd be something I'd be happy to be associated with, too. I appreciate you opening the three bills together, and I thought what I'd do is just try to run through them quickly, tell you how we intend them to work and what is behind them, and I know there are some people who are here more expert than I who can talk about their implementation and what stands between us and their potential passage. So I think they're all relatively straightforward, relatively simply written, and pretty understandable, and I'll just take them in order. And I should say also, Mr. Chair, that I'd be happy with anyone interrupting and asking questions at any time, particularly since I'm potentially going to talk about three different bills at once. House Bill 2728 is about saving for college. And really, all of these stem from a place, I think, that all of us can recognize the connection between the number of people who are working, paying income tax, and giving us the ability to do the things that Oregonians need and want. That is better, is more possible when people are more educated. The co-chairs and certainly know a stat I've quoted before. The unemployment rate reported in December around 9% nationally, certainly a bit higher in Oregon. But among college graduates, it's around 4%. And among women college graduates, it's around 2%. So there's clearly a connection. And all of these bills are aimed at trying to facilitate greater levels of educational attainment and keeping those educated people and talent in Oregon. So 2728 would make it possible for people to directly deposit income tax returns into a 529 account. There's obviously some changes to the forms and operations that the Department of Revenue would undertake, and obviously affects the 529 program, both of whom are here and can speak to that. I believe that we may need some amendments to accomplish it in the way that they both could make it happen, but have been pleased to work with them and believe they're in general support and can make it happen. So that's a relatively simple thing to explain. House Bill 2729 is...
Question?
Yes. Excuse me. Representative Parker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Would this change the limits at all in terms of what can be put into the 529 plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parker, while I think that's a great conversation, this bill does not contemplate that.
Okay. Thanks.
No problem. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2729 is merely a permissive bill that would give counties an additional tool. And I hope as I'm describing this to you, you may have the -1 amendments in front of you, which represent a complete replacement of the bill. It is intended to allow counties to designate zones in which recent college graduates would be able to defer property taxes. And what we have in mind here is someone who is a recent graduate and maybe putting together the dollars to buy a house and have a down payment, as a small deferral could make a difference. And we recognize the situations that our county partners are in, so this is not something that allows the recent college graduate to completely avoid paying those property taxes, but merely a timing mechanism. We think this can fit well with some of the other loan forgiveness programs that exist for needed talent and needed professions. Is something that will allow, I think, will work equally well for urban and rural counties, a variety of situations where a needed influx of talent might be persuaded to come with this sort of an additional tool. Again, it's completely permissive, not obligating anyone to do it, and I think is an additional tool for counties who are seeking new talent.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Representative, is there a definition of defer? In this bill? I didn't see it, but maybe you've got other answers.
Mr.
Chair, the length of time we were talking about deferring for. You're not talking about forgiving or eliminating completely, but deferring for some prescribed period of time. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Do you have the amendments, the -1 amendments in front?
Just am now.
Okay, great. So it's an excellent question in the bill that was originally drafted. We did not have sufficient time to define that very well in the amendment in the bill, but in the amendment, it is there in line 13.
I see that now. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll continue just with 2731.
One more question.
Yes, Representative Parker.
Thank you. You know how pro-education I am, mm-hmm. et cetera, and I'm in favor of loan forgiveness and things like that we can, any steps we can take that will help people more easily or be more able to afford college. This one seems a little bit different to me in that it's not just college grads or community college folks who have gone through and gotten certain degrees that are struggling to buy homes. And it almost feels to me like this would give folks who have achieved some educational status and thus have greater earning potential and thus a leg up on home ownership compared to the folks who do not, it would give them another leg up over folks who haven't gone through the, who haven't met the criteria for this forgiveness. Or, sorry, not forgiveness, deferral.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, thank you for making the distinction. I would not dispute the fact that this is but a piece of what I think ought to be an agenda around higher education. I'm not claiming that this solves all the things that you correctly and eloquently identified. I think this is an additional tool, and I think it's complementary to the loan forgiveness in that someone who might be taking advantage of loan forgiveness programs might be less apt to stay in the community where they've been when those loan forgiveness programs cease. But if they've bought a house, they might be more apt to stay. And I don't think this is, it does say, it has to be, I'll make sure I'm referring to the right specific place, but the intent is that it's only for recent areas. On line 8 of the amendment, it's the graduate within 60 months of the graduation. So it's recent college graduates, and I'm confident that your higher education experience probably brought you much greater levels of income immediately following your graduation than I. But when I was within 60 months, I wasn't quite ready to buy a house yet, so it was still a struggle for me even at that stage. So it's aimed at a specific population. I don't claim that it solves all our higher education issues, but I think it's a useful tool for counties. Again, completely permissive. They may decide that it's not right for their circumstance. They may decide to do it different ways in different counties.
Okay, good. Thanks for the clarification.
Further questions on this particular bill? Anyone? I have a question, Rep. Reed. So do you have a sense that any of the counties might be interested in this? I mean, if it's permissive to them.
Mr. Chair, I would not want to put words in the mouths of counties, but we've had some good discussions, and I think it would be fair to say that they are interested in having additional tools that they might use and contemplate how to use them. And I think there is someone here to speak for counties.
Okay. Good, great. Good.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2731, the last in my trio, is something we call the Earned Education Tax Credit. I think this might be of the three that I'm presenting today, might be the most difficult in the way it's written to understand. The concept itself is quite simple, which is to allow a tax credit, a non-refundable tax credit, for graduates of Oregon institutions, and obviously to take effect, those people would need to be staying in Oregon and applying it against income earned in Oregon. The thought here, again, is that far too many people are not going on to college, and of those who are going on to college from Oregon, too many, to our taste, are leaving Oregon to do that and less likely to come back. So this is aimed at those two populations, someone who is definitely going, the question is whether they're going in Oregon or somewhere else, and at the population who might not be going. We had some good conversations with admissions officers at institutions around the state, asking them what might be an additional tool, and the idea of having a very simple, easy to understand incentive was attractive. That's what this is aimed at. We started with $1,000 tax credit for a four-year degree and worked it into a sort of year-by-year kind of approach. And there are sunsets, and it's, I think, an additional tool that will hopefully incent more people to be going to college and staying in Oregon. I think it's also possible that we did have a revenue impact statement of a moderate amount the last time we proposed this. I think it's possible to argue in a sense that this would pay for itself when more people are going to college, graduating, and earning more and paying more taxes as a result. And I'm happy to have your consideration of this along with the other two.
Okay, questions of Rep. Reed about this bill? Okay, thank you
for
bringing this forward. And now we have some people lined up to talk about it. Is that right, Ms. Teske?
And, Mr. Chair, just as I'm leaving, I would note the Dash 1 amendments for House Bill 2729, I believe, are ready to go. 2728 does need some additional amendments, and my hope is that we'll be able to bring that back to you for further consideration when we have those. The folks who come after me will likely have more to say about that.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. I would call Michael Parker here to talk about 2728, but feel free to address any of the others if you'd like, Mr. Parker.
And
please start by introducing yourself. And let me just say, the policy we're following in this committee is you don't need to address both of us co-chairs to begin with. I'm the co-chair for the day and the chair for the day, and next Tuesday you can talk to Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Jimbro. Members of the committee, for the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. I'll be brief today. I'm going to talk about just House Bill 2728, and we are here to support this bill, to, you know, let the committee know that we think it's good public policy. We think it's another tool to help parents and families save for future higher education expenses. I did want to let the committee know that my office has been working with Department of Revenue to work out some of the logistics to this bill. As Representative Reed mentioned, there'll be some amendments coming back to kind of shore up some of the logistics between our office and Revenue. Nothing earth-shattering, but there will be some amendments. And I do want to let the committee know that that Revenue has a few one-time costs to set up this program in their system, and the network is willing to pay reasonable setup costs to offset some of those costs that Revenue would have to make sure this bill gets implemented properly. So with that, I will happy to take questions.
So just to clarify, Mr. Parker, so there would be no or minimal cost to the state for this startup cost?
Given what I know, the network is willing to pay those reasonable setup costs, so there would be no cost to set this up to the state. As long as those costs are reasonable, we're happy to facilitate those costs.
Very good. Questions of Mr. Parker?
Just a question about the overall program. How many individuals participate in the 529 plan as it currently exists?
Sure. Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, right now, as of the end of the year, we have about $1.3 billion in the entire network. We have two plans that operate. That's in both plans. And about 129,000 accounts.
Okay.
Those represent a majority of Oregonians. We have some out-of-state accounts, but a majority of our accounts, majority of our assets are held in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Parker, what do you think will be the result of the passage of this? Do you think, do you anticipate some, you know, a much higher level of participation?
Chair Dembro, we think it's another good tool. We do a lot of our investors put a lot of money in between January and April when they're doing their taxes, and we feel like letting them know that this is open to them, that the plan is out there. This is another education tool for them. I would not kind of hazard a guess of how many folks. We think it's just another tool, another avenue to help them save for college, to help them really get to understand the need to save and that this is out there. We really are trying to kind of broaden our scope to helping folks understand the needs that they might have to save for college. This is just one more tool for us to do that.
Okay, so no other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I think more on this theme, I'd call up Ms. Bridget Burns, please.
Hello, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bridget Burns. I'm Chief of Staff of the Oregon University System. And today I want to speak in support of 2728 House Bill about the tax-deferred 529 plans. We generally, at the seven universities here in Oregon that are public, we're really committed to developing the cultivation of a college-going culture, and we think that as many resources as we can possibly have to make it feel possible to go to college. That's beneficial for us. And we know that prepaid tuition in the form of college tax-deferred 529 plans is a way to do that, and it's a way for folks to eliminate the amount of debt they need to take out during school, and the less they'll need to depend on their current income while they're in school. So that's a beneficial policy, and it really fits nicely with how at the Oregon University System we're deeply committed to making college affordable and accessible, shown by not just the over $50 million we put towards our own students and their need, but the way that we work with community groups and we work to kind of break down the perceived barriers about access, and we really want to convince folks that this is a possible and attainable goal, and we think that this is a helpful resource towards that end. So I just want to lend our support, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Committee?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Bridget. All right, great. So I have a couple of people who want to speak about 2729. Marcia Kelly and Ann Haynes. Would you please come up? Yes, please. Okay. Thank you. And again, House Bill 2729 is the one having to do with the property tax deferral.
Co-Chair Denbrough and Co-Chair Johnson, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm a policy manager with the Association of Oregon Counties and appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2729. We've appreciated the opportunity to meet with Representative Reed and his staff to brainstorm about this innovative bill and how it would apply in consideration for amendments. And we see that he has introduced Dash 1 amendments to the bill. The legislation has the potential to encourage college graduates to stay in Oregon and to address occupations that are in short supply. We haven't taken a position on the bill, so what I'm going to be talking about today is just some considerations and things we shared in the brainstorming session that we had. We do appreciate that 2729 was drafted so that it's permissive for counties and recognizes the diversity among counties and was drafted to provide as much flexibility in recognition of that diversity, because we could see, for example, you could have the needs of a rural county that may be really needing to attract a physician, for example, so maybe just, you know, a few individuals, and then there could be very different in an urban county where maybe they've got a firm that they're trying to attract that has a shortage of particular types of skills. So some of the brainstorming that we did was talking about should it apply to individuals graduating with a certain number of years. So you're trying to get kind of a younger individuals within and ones that aren't as likely to have the means to purchase a home. Should it apply to only Oregon higher education graduates or open to all graduates? Should it apply to owner-occupied homes? And I see an amendment that it does include that. It also, by the way, includes an amendment in the Dash 1s to have it be within 5 years of graduation. What should the period be for deferral and subsequent repayment? And I see the Dash 1 amendments did include that. It included language for a lien, so it clarified that aspect. Some other things that we brainstormed on, should it be aimed at targeted industry or coordination with state economic development goals? Could you have the zones be targeted in blighted areas? And then a sunset date, and I believe that the Dash 1 amendments do have sunset date in there. Also, since this is a new program and we're very conscious about the fiscal situation of counties, we appreciate that there was inclusion in the Dash 1 amendments, the ability to have an application fee to offset the assessor's costs. And we think that something like that would encourage counties to participate. Also, if the proposed results don't significantly impact tax revenues to counties, schools, and special districts. So with that, thank you very much. And we look forward to working with Representative Reed and the committee.
Why don't we hear from all the panelists, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. And we have some concerns about deferring taxes only for university graduates. We have a senior deferral program. That senior program, however, has the ability to pay back the governmental bodies that depend on property tax. And I don't see anything in this bill that makes provision for the special districts, the school districts, the community colleges, the cities, and the counties to be made whole. Given the limitation that passed in 1990 on the property tax, many of those institutions are struggling to keep up with their costs. The American Association of University Women are members who have achieved either an associate degree or higher from an accredited institution in the United States. We have men members, so I don't say just women. The majority of us are women. We care about education, but we also care about the environment that our citizens are living in and the services that are so necessary to be provided by all of the special districts. And this, to us, seems not quite equitable. And if there might be some provision for making the counties, the cities, the school districts, the special districts whole, that might make it more palatable, but I still think that it's not something that we would want to support.
Thank you. So, Ms. Kelly, following up on your last point, in the amendment, you know, it says that the county may designate an education development zone, and in consultation with representatives of higher education, local government, and the private sector, establish criteria. So is your sense that that's not strong enough in terms of the sort of sign-off that would be required?
I will answer that. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, I don't think that's strong enough. I sit on a board of a special district, and we struggle to pay. We cut back services because we do not have enough property tax revenue to operate the system the way that we would like to and the way that our citizens would like to. There's no provision the county could do this without any consultation with the other districts. We are careful with our money, but the property tax limitation that went in 1990 meant that all local government has $10 with which to spend, and it's a frozen $10. It hasn't been ratcheted up for cost of living. So we're living on $1990 dollars, basically. And I just don't think that the benefit would merit the cost to the local districts.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments related to this?
Yes. Mr. Chair, and it probably isn't to you, I guess it's to the bill at large, but I sympathize with your comments about the special districts. You know, as you look down your property tax statement, there's a number of those, and as a sitting school board member, obviously I'm very cognizant of the school's portion, but we also, as a school board, have a local option levy that helps support our schools as well. We've got park and rec districts. We've got ESD districts that rely upon that revenue as well. So it does seem a little confusing to me to be able to get all those entities to agree to some sort of formula in there to where one of them isn't left out. You know what I mean? It's going to take some work to get everybody to the same conclusion, I guess, working collaboratively to make this thing work.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Johnson, in the Salem area, we did have a property tax management plan for quite some time to try to work through keeping people whole and working together to stay within the $10 limit. But I think that if one entity is the one who's making the decision, they may not take into account the effect that it might have on the other taxing districts. We're operating a transit district within the urban growth boundary of Salem, and we have 8 urban renewal districts in the city of Salem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Why don't we go on to our last panelist, and then we may have questions for all of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue, and we don't take a position on policy issues regarding tax matters, but our interest is in the tax administration and can the bill as written or the amendment be administered. We expressed some interest in a little bit of the openness of the original introduced version, but the draft -1 amendments actually provide a lot more fleshing out of the issues such as, you know, who, when, where, why, and how these people can qualify, when they can be disqualified, what about the lien, when is it paid back, all of those kinds of issues that we as sort of tax wonk type people think about. So appreciate the additional information there. We are in the section 2 of the bill that three on page 2 of the -1 amendment on line 6. We're asked to create a form, sort of a process for claiming these, and so we can imagine that with the additional information that will be a little easier to do. I think the bill is open enough with a little flexibility for counties to target the job classification needs that they're actually searching for, as Ann mentioned, like a physician or maybe a wind turbine type specialization, and there will be a little bit of flexibility in there, and I'm sure we'll be able to work with counties on that and the forms necessary to get the information from the applicant to the actual assessor. So if I can be of any help with questions, I'd be happy to give it.
Committee, questions?
I think my question is to the previous speaker, and I understand the struggles that you go through after Measure 5 in Lane County. We have one of the lowest tax rates in the entire state, and so I'm very, very familiar with what you go through. But as I read the bill, this is a deferral of tax payments, not an elimination of tax payments. And wouldn't this encourage people to move into the district to pay taxes, to own homes, and thereby giving you more money to be able to use for special districts, for county purposes, and again, for the community?
Chair Dembro, Representative Hoyle. In a perfect world, it would, but what do you do for the 10 years that you were not receiving those funds? Because as I did a real quick look at the -1 amendments, which I did not have access to until John shared them with me, it does not make a provision for the governments to be made whole during that deferral time. And that's the concern. We cut Saturday service in Salem because we are on a property tax. And we could not get a local option passed because there were too many things on the ballot wanting money. We got really close, but we didn't get it passed.
Thank you. Rep. Parker.
Thanks. I'm not sure who this question is for. It might be for one of you or Rep. Reed or others, but economic development zones and urban renewal zones are often created to try to change the tone of an area. Is there something, I'm thinking about gaming systems here, okay? And is there anything in this to prevent, I won't go to an extreme, but for instance, to create a really nice gated community for people who have finished higher education and would be in a pretty high price area and could avoid property taxes altogether for 10 years?
Maybe I'll answer that. Co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, Representative Harker, I think that would be where the county could determine exactly where that zone is from on mapping and decide, you know, what areas they want to do. Furthermore, this is fairly narrow so that it's really aimed for graduates within 5 years of graduation. So it would be hard to see a whole subdivision that might be aimed that way, but it's possible, but it really would be dependent about how large of a zone the counties would want to have.
Okay.
And where they would want to have it. One of the things that I mentioned that we brainstormed is that it wouldn't necessarily have to be a new subdivision. You could say we have this part of the city that we want to revitalize and bring in people who are willing to be willing to go into those areas and fix up homes.
Right. Could be that way, but there's nothing in the bill that says it should be that kind of place. And if we think about what I think a couple of people have mentioned as this being an incentive to get folks to settle in an area like that. There's nothing in here that makes it, that requires it to be that type of area.
That's true. I think as I understood from Representative Reed, what he was trying to do was provide as much flexibility and recognition of the various different circumstances that counties may find themselves in.
I think it's an interesting approach. I'm always worried about our unintended consequences of our actions. So, all right, thanks.
Any other questions? Actually, I have another one for Rep. Reed if he'd come back up. Thank you. Thank all three of you for coming.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Ryan. Just, you know, as we're kind of looking at this and potential changes, This bill refers to a graduate of a post-secondary institution and kind of leaves it at that. But what is your thinking about what that means exactly? I mean, that could be someone who has completed a 3-month certificate at a community college or, a culinary institute, you know, or whatever. Do you have a sense of who this would apply to?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. I think my intent is to leave that to the individual counties to decide what it is that they need. I can imagine a very different answer to that depending on if I represented Multnomah or Washington County or Crook County or Harney County or something else. I think it's dangerous to pick up the language of unintended consequences for us to imagine that we know the individual circumstances of any of the 36 counties in Oregon. And that's my intention, to give another tool to the counties to decide what it is they need. And so it's a very broad definition.
Thanks. Okay, well, we got the guy up here. Anybody have any more questions about these?
I would like to point one other thing out, sure. Mr. Chair, and to Representative Parker. It is hard for me to imagine a county, any of the 36 counties, that would feel like they have plenty of dollars for the services that they're trying to provide and that their residents need, who would set up a circumstance like you describe. I think it's much more likely that this would be used to revitalize areas that need talent. And while I appreciate your concern about unintended consequences, I think you can rely on the talented and dedicated people who are in counties who are trying to provide services to not be giving away dollars without a pretty strong feeling that it would be an investment that pays off over time.
We may get to see.
Let's hope.
Thank you, Rep. Reed.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing these forward. Okay, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. No, we have more on this. I'm sorry. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Ms. Kelly, did you want to speak to 2731 as well? I'm sorry. Okay, if you could reintroduce yourself. Thank you.
Right. A little
a little rusty on this. Chair Dembro and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. We have over 1,500 members around the state in places like Lakeview and Baker and Enterprise, LeGrand, Pendleton, Medford, Salem, all over the state. And as I said before, we're members who have an associate degree or above. For at least the last 10 years, we've been working to educate our members on the issues of revenue for the state of Oregon and the structural problems that we have. And part of those structural problems are tax credits and tax incentives that have built up. So we have a tax credit that, you know, you'd think that we'd like because education is important to us. But we have some real concerns on this tax credit. Equity. If you're a displaced worker and you go back to work and you lose your, you want to go back to school, you probably didn't graduate 5 years ago from high school. If you're a mom raising kids and decided to defer college to after the kids are in grade school, you probably don't have a high school graduation or equivalent date within 5 years. So this is only for students who go directly from high school to the community college system or the higher education system. So we think that's inequitable. We think it's complex to administer for the Department of Revenue. They have to verify college or high school graduation in Oregon or the equivalent. Then they have to verify that you did graduate from college. You could send in paperwork to say both of those, but that could game the system. And the big thing is the effect on Oregon's general fund balance. Based on rough estimates from the Oregon University System and the Independent College Association of Oregon, and taking into account that some residents, some are out-of-state students, the first year cost could be as high as $5 million. The second year we'd go to $10,600 because, of course, we have another class coming along. The third year it'd go to $15,900, and the fourth year and every year after that, this is static enrollment and static graduation rates, it could go up to $21 million. And that's just the higher education. The community college is more complex. I got some figures from the Oregon Community College Association on graduation rates. After the second year, it could add a potential of about $2 million to that $21 million figure. The American Association University likes education, but we think that a tax policy that gives away money at the front end without adequately funding the students who need to be in school ready to learn, the kids who might drop out, programs at community colleges, programs at the university. We think it's better to spend the money up front and not after something has been accomplished, because the people who have gotten a college degree or an associate's degree have higher earning power. And so it's a situation where if you spend it on the early days of the kids, they're more likely to stay in school, they're more likely to commence with post-high school education and not drop out, and then be more productive. And I'd rather see the money spent, we'd rather see the money spent that way than giving away money in tax credits.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Anyone have questions of her on this issue? Rep. Parker?
I think it's, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not actually a question for you, but a point of clarification.
Yeah.
the bill referencing these 60 months. I don't think, as I'm reading it, it's not 60 months post high school graduation, right? It's 60. It's graduation from the post secondary institution, 60 months following that, right? So I agree with almost everything you've said. I just want to make sure that I'm interpreting this properly. It doesn't have to be someone who goes straight to school, to post-secondary from high school. Is that correct?
Well, I think the bill says that it defines eligible taxpayer as a taxpayer who graduated from an Oregon high school on or after July 1st, 2011. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were addressing, Ms. Kelly? So it's not going to apply to the returning student, to the older student. And I think that is an important point. Do you mind coming back? And we have time, we're on time, so maybe you could address your intent on that. Why focus on future high school graduates as opposed to existing high school graduates?
Mr. Chair, I would say that if it's the committee's pleasure, we could certainly open that up. However, it's an interesting dilemma that's been presented because, on the one hand, I hear concerns about the revenue impact. On the other hand, I hear concerns that this is too narrow. So those kind of conflict. I elected to aim at the more recent graduates of high school because I think, as we've heard, all of you on this committee particularly, that's one of the most important indicators of our future economic success, the educational attainment of future generations. I envision this as a pilot project, and it has a sunset on it. If we determine that this works and is a useful expenditure, then we can expand it. It makes sense to me that we're talking about those numbers. I'm on the Revenue Committee and the Joint Tax Credits Committee, where we're endeavoring to make sure that we're considering these kinds of expenditures along the same lines as we do direct expenditures, because they are the same. So I welcome the scrutiny about that. That's why there's a sunset, and why we will, if we decide to pass this, we'll come back and try to determine if it's useful. If it's not, we shouldn't continue doing it.
And I realize now that I was wrong about, you were correct in your assessment, and I was wrong because I was looking just at the front portion and not about the dates, which the dates on section 4. So you were right. Okay.
So just to clarify what you said, Representative Reed, your sense of this is that this will go to the Committee on Tax Credits, and it'll be weighed, I mean, eventually will go to that committee and be weighed against other potential tax credits.
Mr. Chair, in general, that's true. I think the setup in this session is that proposed new tax credits would go to the Revenue Committee. The extensions of existing tax credits would go to the Joint Committee. But the thrust of your comment is exactly right.
Questions, comments? Okay. Thank you. And that's the last time I'll call you back up.
No problem.
Referee. Thank you again.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you. Okay. If there are no further comments on these bills, I am going to end the public hearing on House Bills 2728, 2729, and 2731. And Representative Johnson and I will talk about eventual scheduling of a work session on these bills. Okay. Now I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3042, and I would ask, maybe that was too fast.
It's permissive, which is the only thing.
We can move forward and then...
we don't have Andrew either, do we?
We can make a phone
call. Yeah, there's representatives here.
Is Andrew here?
Is Andrew...
I don't think so. Andrew, you're not here.
Thomas,
are you going to be doing the... okay.
I think I messed up on
All right, I'm going to... So I close the public hearing.
You close the public hearing.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3042. That was a really fast hearing. And now I am going to open...
Pardon me.
No.
Sorry, Andrew is with...
Now we've done
this, but this is Thomas. So he's with 3042.
Oh, I see.
We're still on 3042.
So we're on 3042. For good measure.
Sorry, Thomas. I just gave you a job with Rep Buckley. But maybe, yeah.
For good measure, let's just open up the hearing on 3042 again.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3042. And Anna, if you could introduce us to this bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3042 stipulates that tuition and or fees collected by the food and beverage career programs for courses relating to the consumption and possession of alcohol is not considered the sale of alcoholic beverage. Allows educational programs to serve alcoholic beverage to students between 18 and 20 years of age, and allows for the possession and consumption of alcohol under the supervision of the educational provider for training purposes. Permits property owners to allow persons between 18 and 20 years of age that possess and consume alcohol for educational purposes to remain on the property. Becomes operative September 2nd, 2011. Declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you.
Okay. Great, thank you, Anna. And we have a couple of people to speak to this bill. If you could just introduce yourself, Thomas.
Sure. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Thomas Cuomo, legislative assistant for Representative Olson. Unfortunately, he's tied up in a meeting right now with Senator Courtney's office, so I'm going to try to read his testimony as eloquently as he would. And then following my reading of his testimony, Ms. Sullivan will have a testimony as well. And then I'd like to invite our special guests to come up and field any questions that you might have. Dear co-chairs and members of the committee, early last year, I was contacted by Scott Anselm, the program director and retired instructor, Gary Snyder of the culinary program at Lynn Benton Community College. They shared about a dilemma they were experiencing in the program tied directly to education and the business community. This is how simple the dilemma or problem was. Students enrolled in the culinary program could not fully benefit and learn in order to move forward in their chosen profession. Those students enrolled in the program under the age of 21 were prohibited from handling and tasting alcohol. You see, learning the different tastes and odors becomes extremely important to master the culinary program and be effective in the business world. As a result of this issue, Christy Sullivan and I began to meet on several occasions with the program directors of Lynn Benton Community College, Oregon State University, as well as Chemeketa Community College. Included in our meetings involved students, a representative of OLCC, and a member of the Lynn County Sheriff's Office to assist with crafting House Bill 3042. House Bill 3042 has been created with sideboards ensuring the current laws governing minors and alcohol are maintained, and identified each program has in place policies that chart the course between instructors and students that would not violate any OLCC laws. This bill is truly a win-win in today's environment, and there are numerous other states that have moved forward with similar policy. I urge this committee to move this bill forward to the House floor. Sincerely, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Thomas. Very, very well delivered. Maybe almost as well as the representative would have.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Okay, next.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Christy Sullivan, and I reside in Jefferson, Oregon. I submit my testimony today before the committee on in support of House Bill 3042. I was a member of the work group that studied this issue during the interim, and at that time I was in the employ of State Representative Andy Olson, but I need to clarify that I am not testifying today in my current employment capacity. Oregon is gaining an excellent reputation as a producer of superb wines and microbrews, and as our reputation grows, the interest in these careers in the food and beverage industry also grows. However, one thing is holding our college-age students back. They are not allowed to be fully educated in wine, beer, and spirits until they are of the age of 21 in our state. If Oregon students are not permitted to fully participate in their culinary education by learning the varied varied nuances of wines, microbrews, and spirits, then the job openings that are in our state will be filled by applicants that are out of state. How many 18-year-olds do you know who would want to wait until they're 21 to begin their career in the food and wine and beverage industry that includes wines and microbrews and spirits? Even if they complete their studies in this career area, they lag behind other students from other states by at least 3 years because they've had to wait to actually experience all the fine parts of wines and microbrews. If House Bill 3042 is passed, then 18, 19, and 20-year-olds will be allowed to learn all of these aspects of the beverages they are studying, and the full knowledge of these subjects can only be learned by fully studying and experiencing it. And here's something to think about. If pastry chefs and chocolatiers were not allowed to taste any of their creations for the first 3 years of their education, how much excellence would they gain? Probably not very much. But right now, however, Oregon's food and beverage career graduates do not possess as much knowledge as necessary to be competitive in today's job market. More highly trained students from out of state are often hired for jobs because they have been able to gain more practical knowledge. The practical knowledge is very important throughout all the years of their studies, while our students have had to wait until they turn 21 to gain that knowledge. Our students will continue to fall behind the students from out of state unless this law is changed. So House Bill 3042 is a win-win situation for Oregon. More students would enroll in these career programs if the law was changed. The dollars paid for education would stay in Oregon instead of going out of state. And these career programs might possibly attract students from other states, which would be another win for Oregon. Educating more students in Oregon would increase the chances that those students would pursue careers in Oregon and would stay in Oregon, because that often is the case. Oregon's food and beverage career graduates would be better equipped to compete in the job market if this bill passes. As more students study in Oregon and choose to live and work in Oregon, our food and beverage industry will grow much stronger, and so will Oregon's economy. House Bill 3042 is a good piece of legislation. If passed, students will have the choice to stay in Oregon to gain the knowledge necessary to be competitive in today's economy. It's a good bill. It's good for our students. It's good for Oregon, and it's good for Oregon's economy. I urge your support of House Bill 3042 for our students so that they will not lag behind 3 years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you very much, Christy. I do have a couple of questions. You know, first of all, I want to say this is a bill that makes a lot of sense to me.
Was in
the work of the work group, was there any research done as to whether this is a problem in other states as well? Would Oregon be kind of on the cutting edge in looking at this, or do other states not enforce their relevant laws as carefully as we do?
Well, it's quite varied because there are many states whose drinking ages are different, but I think Scott would probably be better to answer that one.
And then we'll hold that.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. And do you foresee any problems with college freshmen who are younger than 18?
They would not be allowed to participate. They would have to be 18 before they could begin the participation in the program.
Okay. Committee, other questions? Representative
More Johnson. Of a comment than a question, Mr. Chair. And Thomas, you did do a fine job. I would admit, though, I was looking forward to having Rep. Olson here before the committee. I've had a lot of inquiries from folks in our caucus about the booze bill that we were hearing today, so I was looking forward to that. But I assure them that I worked with Rep. Olson to remove the portion that he had in here about declaring marijuana an herb. So this is much, much more tame than it could have been. So anyway, great job, and I'll give Rep. Olson a good report.
Appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, so now I'd like to call up Scott Anselm, Haley Delkey, Sammy Laskos. I don't know how many of you we can fit up here. Three at a time. Do you want to kind of crowd around?
Grab the two other chairs.
Sure. And while they're doing so, Rep. Springer has a comment.
Just a brief point of clarification, since I am a signer on this bill, there was no reference to marijuana in the bill.
I got to him early.
For the record.
This stretched me a little bit.
Okay, Mr. Anselm, thank you for coming. And if you could just identify yourself first.
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Scott Anselm. I'm a resident of Salem, and I submit my testimony today on House Bill 3042 as a member of the work group on the bill and as chair of the culinary program at Lynn Benton Community College. With me today are three individuals who will be able to answer questions you may have from their unique perspective. Haley Delkey is a current student in the first year of our program. She graduated from West Salem High School, where starting in her freshman year, she participated in the ProStart Culinary Program, a high school curriculum developed by the National Restaurant Association. She represents a growing population of students that are focused early on a career, gain skill in high school, and then articulate to culinary or college programs. She is a serious professional and a driven student who is currently unable to fully participate in our program because she is under 21 and will be under 21 until after she graduates. Sammy Laskos is a recent graduate and a current employee of our program. She attended high school in Ashland, where she earned several scholarships participating in the culinary program. She's a gifted culinarian, passionate about food. She turned 21 in the middle of her second year of our program and can offer the perspective of a student with the impact of within the second year finally being able to participate in the tasting part of the program. Bryce Snyder completed his program in year 2000 while still under the age of 21. He offers the perspective of completing the program without ever being able to fully participate in the food and beverage pairing process. Although he possesses a great interest, has a gifted and discerning palate, he had to wait until after our program before he could pursue those interests. Now he is working towards a degree in fermentation science and plans to attend OSU. This bill would allow education of 18, 19, and 21-year-olds enrolled in culinary arts and other educational institutions in Oregon to learn about wine, beer, and spirits so they can compete for Oregon jobs currently filled by out-of-state graduates who get this specialized education before 21. Oregon has established growing, world-respected culinary wine, brewing, and spirit industries. Educational institutions in Oregon are stepping up to the plate, establishing programs to meet Oregon's need for trained culinary and beverage workforce. Our Oregon students should not have to go to California, New York, or elsewhere to get a complete education, nor should they have to be disadvantaged by taking an additional 3 years to gain the skills to compete for higher paying jobs when those out-of-state graduates can come compete for those jobs at a much younger age. We're asking today for the tools to properly educate local world-class workforce. It should be our goal in the community college as well as other institutions of higher learning in Oregon to prepare students to be the best possible employees we can to support these and other Oregon industries. The current law severely inhibits the ability to achieve this goal because while students can serve alcoholic beverages, at 18, 19, and 20, they are not allowed to receive much of the needed formal education about the beverages they are serving. That is a travesty for the industry, for the students, and for the better paying jobs our Oregon students could have earlier with a specialized knowledge. We are now encouraging the import of other states' graduates to fill higher paying jobs that Oregonian employers create. I've been in the culinary industry for 37 years. I helped open the Horstmager Culinary Institute, now the Le Cordon Bleu College of Culinary Arts in Portland. I've been at Lincoln-Benton Community College since 1986. I know the value of completing and having a complete education in the culinary arts, including alcoholic beverages, before the age 21 by personal experience. I began my career at 16 while working in restaurants during high school. After I graduated, I attended Portland Community College for a year in their culinary program. Following that, I went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. At that time, the legal drinking age in New York was 18. This allowed me and my classmates to fully participate in classes covering components of food pairing, the finer points of beer, wine, and spirits, all of which included tasting. Our wine class final required identification of a wine, including grape variety, where it was produced, and what year it was produced, solely by taste, smell, and appearance. With a thorough and complete education in beverages, including wine, beer, spirits, as well as food, I was prepared to be sous chef and then chef of the Coot Street Fish House, then a fine dining restaurant in Portland, at age 22. As part of this position, I was expected to select wine to offer with menu items, to work with potential clients, to plan events such as wine pairing dinners. I would not have been able to be successful in this position at that age had I not had the full benefit of an education outside of Oregon that included alcohol and spirits, wine, and several years to build the knowledge base that I needed after receiving that education. My fellow Oregonians who stayed at local schools had no chance to compete here or in other states at an early age. My graduates and students under the age of 21 today face the same disadvantage. The employers who would like to hire local students as they graduate can't hire them expecting the same knowledge base that many candidates have from out of state. Let me clarify the type of activity I'm referring to, because I find many people have not been exposed to technical tasting. Too often, when we refer to wine tasting, it brings to mind a social event, a beer, wine, or other tasting, people in the evening, where the social aspects are as or more important than gaining a knowledge of the beverage. That's very different than a technical tasting. The technical tasting is part of a class. It is strictly supervised. It is orchestrated and monitored with specific purpose in mind. Please imagine that this is my class, these are my students, and we now have four red wines from Oregon from four different regions. They're all Pinot Noirs. One's been aged in neutral oak, an oak barrel that's been used to the point where you don't get much oak. One has been aged in American oak. One has been aged in French oak. And one in a stainless steel tank. Before the students even taste wine, I will have water, hopefully with oak from those same barrels soaked in it. I may have other components for the students to sniff and taste. The characteristics of those components can then be recognized in the flavor of the wine. Now I help the students learn to detect the differences and discuss with me and their fellow students how those components will interact with various food flavors. Most of the wine is not swallowed, but rather taken into the mouth, tasted, spit out. Actual consumption during the class is minimal. Technical tasting is not about consumption, it's about learning. Imagine now, Haley, our youngest student, planned a menu, put in all of the work, all of the time to have that menu, create that menu. It's time to pick the wine for that dinner. She sits on the sidelines. She's unable to participate while the other two students taste, smell, and take what should be pairing with her menu and select the wine. That scene will happen again and again during the program while she's there, and she will never be able to fully participate. I need the ability to teach students, perhaps the future winemakers, the future chefs, to match food and wine, including understanding all the flavor nuances that are exhibited in fine wine. As you can see, this is a legitimate and necessary education to ensure graduates can positively contribute to the culinary industry in Oregon. As I'm sure you can appreciate even more now, the education is not possible without tasting beverages that our restaurant, vintners, and brewers offer as part of their fare. The skill and knowledge base to succeed in the culinary industry takes years to acquire. Beginning education at 18 years of age will allow our students to at least have entry-level skills and knowledge by the time they complete most degree programs. Knowledge of wine, beer, and spirits promotes responsible consumption of these products as an integral part of a meal to be consumed in moderation for the person to appreciate the nuances of these beverages. The consumption quickly becomes about the art and complexity of a carefully produced beverage and how these flavors enhance food, the dining experience, not about getting a buzz. By the way, I passed the final I mentioned. It was a 1974 Bordeaux comprised of Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. I was 19. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Scott. Questions of Mr. Anselm? Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the testimony. And for me, this will be a no-brainer. I have some questions about what the qualifying classes are, just in general, not in specific. But in the summary of the bill, it mentions that with the approval of the education provider, these people can participate as part of a workshop or seminar concerning food or beverage industry training. So I'm thinking of my brother-in-law who runs the Washington Wine Academy in Washington, D.C. He conducts general purpose educational courses for the public. He also conducts Wine and Spirit Education Trust programs that run for months at a time, and Master of Wine program classes. Under this proposed legislation, can these students participate in those educational, in any or all of those courses?
Chair Demarest, Representative Harker, I believe the answer is yes. We tried to draft the bill in a way that not only captured the full-time student in a program, but also the seminars that we might offer, Oregon State might offer other programs to industry people. We're now having second-generation employers coming in and looking for education and seminars.
Yeah, so the language says that the person is enrolled as a student in a required or elective class that is part of a food or beverage career program offered by the education provider. I mean, that sounds to me like something that's going to be more than just a one-time kind of, class.
Right, but there are people training to be sommeliers in these classes,
mm-hmm.
and they're working at a restaurant. They're not involved in they're not attending a culinary institute like you folks are or have, but they're still gaining this information and training critical to exactly the type of careers that you're talking about.
Correct.
So I'm not clear on it. I'm not sure that we need to be really clear on it right now, but I think it is interesting and it may come up at some point.
I will with great delight call up Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Real Representative Olson.
Representative out of the Albany area. Mr. Chairs and Representative Harker, your question. Scott said yes, that's exactly what it is. It's designed specifically because we had this discussion during the meetings that we held And what the intent was behind this was that we would actually, for those, it's a controlled environment is what we're after, and we feel that that's what the bill did. We had a lengthy discussion about this with Chuck Taylor when we were crafting this through Legislative Council.
Actually, since you're up here, Rep. Olson. Can you tell us who was involved in this work group? You know, what kind of people weighed in on the matters at hand here?
Absolutely. Just to give you a really quick nutshell version of it, Mr. Chair. Initially, we had someone from the Sheriff's Office in Linn County that was connected with Scott. That was interested in this because you were actually the one that were interested in seeing something along this line come along. And then from there, we invited the professor and director of the program from OSU, who is here, Rob, then also from Chemeketa Community College that has a very progressive, culinary as well. We had students involved with us as well through this. Christy Sullivan was involved from the very beginning, helping walk through this with us. Linda from OLCC, who's in the back, was with us at the very beginning because we wanted to go in the right direction for the connection of what we wanted to do with the law regarding minors in possession, tasting, and just handling alcohol. So that's kind of the nutshell version. And there were some others as well.
Great, thank you. Sounds like a good group. Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for your testimony for sure, Scott. And this is a bit of a rhetorical question because I think I know the answer. However, I assume, assuming this bill passes, that the college will be adopting policies that assist you and support you in implementing this. And so talk to me a little bit about that process, if you would.
Chair Denbrough, Representative Springer, yes. We actually talked about that as in our committee, too, whether to put that in the bill and decided it was best to leave it to the individual colleges who all currently have, all of us that teach anything related with alcohol, have policies in place. Ours is that we don't ever serve more than what ends up being the alcohol equivalency that's referred to in the bill. Many of the classes, it is not just suggested but required that the students spit, that they don't consume most of the wine. Implementation might be different at the different schools, but that is certainly a part of our that we contemplate having to do that and or already have many policies in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of Scott or the representative before
Mr.
we
Chair?
Go on to our expert witnesses?
Yes. Do anyone of you know how many culinary institutes or programs currently exist in Oregon and approximately how many graduates do we turn out each year for out of them? Anybody? Sounds like it's more than just your particular institution. There's quite a few.
Well, Mr. Chairs, I do not know that answer. You know, we can probably figure that out. We do have the professor from OSU that's going to be testifying as well, I believe,
okay.
Rob, so he can give you a little bit of perspective, too, from what's happening with their program over there.
Follow-up. And Rep. Olson, just for the record, I'm wondering if you prefer Chardonnays aged in oak or stainless steel?
Think before you answer. This is a big question.
Thank you.
You're in trouble.
Okay. Thank you, both of you, Scott. And now the students, would you like to come forward? Thank you. Okay, so you can speak in the order you want. Just introduce yourself by name before you begin, and then tell us why we should support this bill.
I'll begin. My name is Sammy Laskos. I'm from the LBCC Culinary Arts Program. I graduated 2 years ago, and I'm now an employee. I turned 21 just in time for the planning of our last banquet, which is kind of the big to do of your second year. It's what you aspire to be successful at. It's 7 to 8 courses with 2 to 3 wine pairings, and being able to participate in pairing the wines for that banquet as opposed to the 5 banquets I planned previous without being able to do that, it really rounded out the experience. Without it, there is a definite gap in what you learn, especially being expected to go out into the industry and pair beverages with your food.
Great, thank you.
My name is Haley Dalkey, and I'm from Lynn Benton Community College. I am 18 and just graduated last year. I will be graduating next spring when I'm 20, and I don't turn 21 until a year after. I've been part of planning at least one banquet. We're in the middle of planning our second, and there's been a couple times that they've been doing a lot of wine pairing and choosing to go with our courses, and as Scott said, I've been involved in culinary for a very long time, and I try to get every aspect as I can, and try to help when I can, and it's not very fun to sit on the sidelines and have something that I can't partake in.
Thank you very much, Haley.
My name is Bryce Snyder. I live in Albany, Oregon. I started the culinary program right out of high school. I was 18, and I completed the program when I was still 20. During that time, in your second year, you're involved with planning several different banquets, and pairing with food and wine, or beer and wine, is very important with that. I can recall one very specific banquet we did that was several different regions of the U.S., and a large focus on that was pairing it with beer. I had to basically sit out of that process entirely. When I graduated the program, I went back for one pairing food with wine course after I turned 21. And my exposure in terms of a culinary pairing context was very limited because of my age circumstances. I moved up to Portland and began just to kind of develop my own enthusiasm for beer and wine and spirits, primarily with craft microbrews, and now decided to pursue an education in making those for a living. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, all three of you. Questions of the of these panelists? I would just to make a comment, I would think that someone who is training to be a professional in your craft would feel awfully frustrated in your situation, and it must be very hard to just kind of imagine what, I'm sure you read about what the pairings, you know, should be, and you hear people's testimony, but not being able to really experience it directly, must be a huge challenge.
Especially when we're in a circumstance with trained professionals who are very educated, that's the opportunity to try this wine with an apple and a piece of bread and cheese and taste the difference and see the nuances that come through. It's an opportunity you don't have after the program.
Yes, Representative Parker.
I don't know if any of you can answer this, but if we were to do this, I imagine you might look for work in restaurants during the summer. Does the program go year-round? I'm assuming that there's a break. Okay, so if there's a break in the summer, you would look for an apprenticeship or a job in a restaurant somewhere, maybe land one. Are you able, would these people be able to continue your education in pairings there? No.
Yes, Scott, would you like to just reintroduce yourself and answer that? Thank you.
No.
Back to the really controlled situation.
We didn't have a way to put sideboards on without
just going to be on that. So the legal consumption is restricted to the class context, is that right?
Yes, class, that is part of the accrediting institution, I believe.
Great. Thank you. Yes, anything else you'd like to add, any of you? Well, thank you very much for coming. It's really helps us to put a human face onto this this situation that we're trying to repair. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we have Robert McGoran from OSU who would like to speak to us as well.
Chair Gambro, I think I'm not sure if I'm on the list, but I also have a Gary Snyder.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. You're tucked in the middle.
Indeed.
Sorry.
Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Robert McGoran. I'm the Department Head of Food Science and Technology at Oregon State University. I'm here this afternoon to testify on behalf of House Bill 3042. So I have 11 years' experience as Department Head of Food Science, and in the 11 years I've been here in Oregon as head of the department, we've seen our program grow 400%. We now have 160 students. We're about 40 in the year 2000. The reason for that growth is we're one of two programs in the country that basically offer both fermentation science as well as enology and viticulture and a traditional food science option. So in terms of our program, our students, again, are trained in those three separate areas. They elect the specific option that they choose to study in, and certainly our fermentation science program is extremely popular because of the reputation of Oregon for the microbreweries in Portland and certainly breweries in Bend and Hood River, Newport, throughout the state, and certainly the tremendous growth of our Oregon Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris industry, and also Southern Oregon and in the Milton Freewater area of the state. So this is a tremendous economic growth engine for our state. Our students, most of them are 21 when they get into our senior classes. Our senior classes that involve tasting of brewing analysis is our 461 class, and our wine production analysis and sensory evaluation class is 467. The reason these are senior classes is our students have to take a foundation of food chemistry and microbiology and related food science courses. I would guess, though, however, most of our students are 21 when they're taking those classes, but consistently about 10% of the students are not. So those students that are under 21 when they're taking these senior-level classes are, again, deprived, as you've heard from the other testimony, they're deprived of the experience to be able to taste samples that, for example, have sensory defects. This is truly a technical tasting, so the samples that the graduate student or the professor prepares are good samples that are spiked, for example, with diacetyl, which brings in a butter note, or with methoxypyrazine, which is a green bell pepper note, or you know other components. So these components, these tastings are typically something that you sip and spit out. But the idea is for the students to be exposed to particular fermentation defects or sulfur compounds or sulfur off flavors that are produced when fermentations don't go right. So our careers, our students are being prepared to go be winemakers or to be brewing assistants or assistant brewmasters. And so they have to learn all the nuances of the fermentation. So it is a very much a controlled environment in either case where the students are over 21. As it is now, they have very small amounts of samples that they're tasting in a class period. They're heavily supervised by the instructor. The samples are costly to prepare, so there's not great quantities to begin with. So there's a financial component as well for us that are delivering these courses. So back to the students that are under 21 now would basically have to sit out the experience, and what we've done is special accommodations in the past where the students basically are waived of the required. They do pass the course, but they have not had the full complement, the full educational experience, and it's unfortunate in those cases. Our courses are offered once a year, so if the student wanted to delay a year, that would have a financial penalty as well as a delayed graduation. So it's not practical under the current set of circumstances to do that. So unfortunately, the students that would be less under 21 would not be able to achieve the full benefit of that educational experience. So basically, we're very much in support of this bill because it would help us get over those unique situations. And certainly, again, our students are being well prepared for job opportunities in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you. Robert, but Gary, why don't we hear from you first, and then we'll take questions.
Chair Dembro?
About 5 minutes, I think, for this piece.
Okay. Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Gary Snyder, and I reside in Lebanon, Oregon. I'm here to submit my testimony today, Education Subcommittee on Higher Education, support of Bill HB 3042 as a member of the work group. I'm also retired from LBCC. I won't go into some of the testimony that's already been given, basically, but prior to my employment at Lynn Benton Community College, I had a business, retail, wine shop, and restaurant in Corvallis for 14 years, and I guess the perspective I'd like to offer is one of the retail, and as a business person, this bill would certainly help create a workforce that's necessary. When we first opened our wine shop in 1978, there were fewer than 50 Oregon wineries. Now there's over 300. The potential for the Oregon wine industry is still in its infancy. We've got a number of, because of the uniqueness of Oregon and its climate, we've got the potential of rivaling regions of Burgundy and Tuscany as far as our quality of wine and the microbrews also. So, you know, this area is very important to the state. It's very important economically. And, you know, to have a workforce, and again, it's something that not everyone can do. If you don't have an above-average palate, you've got to be able to taste the nuances. You've got to be able, it's kind of like, you know, how do you explain a color if you can't see it? You know, if you don't taste, if you don't experience with controlled tasting so that you know what the components are, then it's difficult to evaluate beer and wine and to match it with the flavors and food. So, you know, again, I won't go over all the things that have already been covered, but from a business background, it certainly helps. I know the Oregon wine industry itself would support this, in fact do, because they need the workforce. They need people who are trained, who are able to. In fact, we've had students that have gone through our program that are now winemakers in the area and also out of the area. So it really is would be a benefit, I think, to the state and to the students. So thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Questions? Either of these witnesses? Okay, thank you, both of you. Just speaking for myself, I would be happy to move this bill to a work session today, and I suspect so would Rep. Johnson, but we can't. Because we don't yet have a fiscal analysis of it. So we will bring it forward very soon, I promise.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I will close this public hearing on House Bill 3042, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2221. Anna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2221 authorizes the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to award Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence scholarships to qualified students. Initial scholarship of $2,000 may be awarded by OSAC to qualified students and permit 3 additional years of scholarship eligibility by demonstrating measurable gain in language proficiency for a maximum award of $8,000 over 4 academic years. Grants reduce scholarships of $500 less than amount received in previous academic years for students not demonstrating measurable gain, and prohibits awarding reduced scholarships in consecutive academic years. Requires OSAC to adopt rules that, one, establish priorities when scholarship funds are insufficient to award all qualified students, 2, create standards for language proficiency and improvement, 3, assessment methods that comply with the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages guidelines and measures only intermediate mid-level language skills and higher, establishes Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence Fund and continuously appropriates monies in fund to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for purposes of scholarship awards. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Anna. And with that, I'll call up Andrew to tell us what the good representative's thinking was in developing this bill. And we'll then hear from Gisette Green from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. You might as well come up now, Gisette. This is Gisette Green Week here in this committee, and we're happy to have you.
It's getting to be old home.
All right, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley. He had hoped to be here, but just couldn't tear himself away from the budget, apparently. Not sure there's much more to say. Anna did a great job of summarizing the bill, but I can give you a bit of background about where this bill came from.
It was actually introduced last session as House Bill 2756, and some of the members of the subcommittee were on the Education Committee that saw fit to pass that out to Ways and Means. Fortunately, we couldn't move it any further than that at the time, but hopefully we can get some more traction this session. So the bill itself comes from the it's one component of the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence developed by the Center for Applied Second Languages at the University of Oregon. And the intent of the roadmap is to create the conditions that will allow every Oregon graduate to be professionally proficient in English and functionally proficient in another language by 2025. And the thinking behind this is that as the goal market grows and Oregon hopes to attract businesses and retain businesses here in our state, we want to have a workforce that is able to operate in more than a single language. So the bill does its part by authorizing OSAC to award a Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence Scholarship for individuals attending a higher education institution here in the state of Oregon and who are proficient in speaking, reading, and writing in a second language. And as Anna noted, the scholarship would be worth up to $2,000 a year with a maximum of $8,000, and of course the student would be held accountable for continuing to increase his or her proficiency in the language. So please take note that the bill does not actually appropriate any funds to OSAC for the scholarship this session. As you may have heard, the state is lacking in money at the current time. But setting up the framework this year really would be helpful to allowing us to quickly implement the scholarship should we make it out and the legislature be willing to fund the scholarship in the future. And it would also allow OSAC to accept donations and grants for the scholarship starting right away. With that, I will turn it over.
Thank you, Andrew. Josette, maybe you could give us the reaction of OSAC to this, and is this tell us if you feel this is a welcome part of the OSAC family, and any other background.
I'd be delighted to. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the House Higher Education Subcommittee. I'm Josette Green with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and here today to talk about House Bill 2221. So thank you for having me here today and allowing me this opportunity to speak. As you know, OSAC has the innovative program of offering more than 400 scholarships to our students around the state, and we would be delighted to be able to encompass this scholarship into our programs and indeed would be able to administer this program. We, of course, would have to write additional OARs in order to meet the parameters, and that is something certainly within our purview and would be able to do. There is a second element, though, I want to bring to your attention, that in our ability to be able to administer the program, we'd like to amend the bill so that the funds go into the appropriate account. As mentioned, the fund is being open to funds for both state and private donors, and therefore funds need to go into an appropriate account. Right now in the bill, section 37A, it's indicating both state funds and private funds will go into the same account. We need that differentiated. We need for private funds to go into ORS 348.570 section 1, which is the Oregon Student Assistance Fund, and then any state funds, well, private funds go into that account, state funds go into the account as outlined in the bill. So we'd like to propose that amendment to the bill. And given that, we'd be in full agreement for administering the program. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, and I'd be open to any questions.
Yes, just on that last point, Josette. So you could blend those funds, though, for the purpose of giving scholarships, right?
Yes, indeed. We'd administer the same OARs to both funds, no problem. But we do need that distinction between state and private donors.
Okay. Questions? Yes, Representative Hoyle.
I'm just wondering, I really like the idea of this. My background's international trade, and I think that we need to do everything we can to participate in a stronger way in a global economy. But as it's written, if the amendment's brought forward, if we pass this, what effect would Senate Bill 242 have on this? Would this fit into the newly proposed structure, or would this have to be changed at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, in respect to Senate Bill 242, it allows us to administer the programs as they are today. There's no change on that, so I would see no effect.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please pose your question in English, if you would.
Thank you. Amin, Lori. And actually, that's a perfect segue, because I have the same questions about this that I did last time around, which is, tell me how English doesn't qualify as the second language here. Tell me how this is not open to someone who arrives here, meets all the other criteria, and is fluent in a non-English language, and is making progress in the second language here, being English.
Andrew?
Chair Dembrough, Representative Harker. As we noted last session, the bill came to us from the Center for Applied Second Languages at the University of Oregon, and we dropped it as they had wished. And I think their intention here was, just their focus is so much on second languages other than English, mm-hmm. that is why the bill is written that way. And I can't say that we'd necessarily be averse to opening it up, but that's a policy decision for the committee, of course.
Okay.
So,
yes,
I'm fully in support of everyone speaking multiple languages, and I'm not going to stand in the way of this, but I think there's a little hole in it.
Yeah, I'd like to speak to that, but first, Representative Hoyle.
Well, my question, and to follow up on Representative Harker is saying, for any of the grants that you provide, grants are only eligible to U.S. citizens who have residency, qualify for residency in Oregon. They've lived here for 3 years minimum. Is that not true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, thank you for the question. In relation to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, yes, one of the criteria is that the individual must be a citizen or eligible non-citizen. However, when it comes to scholarships, the donor can specify what that citizenship requirement could be.
Thank you.
As I recall, the genesis of the bill, one of the real impetuses here was to the focus was actually on kids in high school to get them interested in languages and to be interested in pursuing foreign language study when they got to college. And I think that's why we have the piece here that they have to have graduated the year before. This is specifically not designed for returning students, but for students who are moving from high school to college or university. I'm not 100% comfortable with that aspect of it, that it only applies to newly graduated students. But, I do respect the purpose of it as the focus being on kids in high school. But to that point, I think that's related, to the question that you posed, Rep. Harker, that, the purpose of it is to get kids in U.S. high schools whose language of currency is English, whether that's their native language or not, that's what they're surrounded by, but to get them interested in pursuing a further foreign language. And to look forward to that when they're in college. So I assume that that's the intent of it.
Mm-hmm. Chair Dember, I would agree.
So I have a follow-up question, Andrew. Do you have a sense that the representative would be interested in an amendment to the bill that would, we've heard of an amendment dealing with the funds, with an amendment that would open it up to students who are returning to college?
Chair Dembrough, I can't imagine that Representative Buckley would be opposed to that. He's always encouraged higher education for all individuals. So. But of course, I would have to check with him. Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
A couple. I'm guessing, and this could go to both of you, I guess, but the intent in trying to encourage language proficiency would be to improving, let's say, the marketability of our workforce, improving maybe the focus of students in school. I mean, all those could be wrapped up into that. But I'm wondering, what other, let's say, higher achievement technical type scholarships does OSAC offer, if any? What I'm getting at, do we offer scholarships to somebody who would look for a higher degree in computer engineering or something like that? As we talk about the full spectrum of trying to improve the state of Oregon's, not just the graduates, but then those folks that are now live here, reside here, can be a part of our workforce and our workforce development and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I wish I had a quick answer for you. With over 400 different scholarships, and each has different criteria for it. I would be glad to research and get back to you on that. So we will research.
There do exist other types of scholarships like that, is that correct?
Again, I would want to research and take a look at that. So.
Actually, just to follow up on that, Gisette, could you say just a little bit about the variety of scholarships that OSAC administers? I mean, last time you were here, we really focused on the Opportunity Grant, but OSAC also administers a number of private scholarships and partnership kinds of scholarship, yes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Thank you for this opportunity to elaborate on it. Yes, with over 400 different scholarships, one of our very unique relationships is the public-private relationships that we have with the Oregon Community Foundation, with the Ford Family Foundation. We are the agency that administers their scholarship programs. Along with that, we work with maybe a local Rotary Club. An individual through their estate planning has determined that they want their funds to go into scholarships. So we work with a variety across the state, with anyone who have the funds and they want them dedicated to scholarships, with a few parameters, of course, but for the most part, it allows us the opportunity to be able to offer more funding to our students to go on to higher education. And we're very unique in the nation to be able to do this. It is not, in fact, it's the only state that does it to this extent, to capitalize on the public and private funds and get those to our students. And so it's a great asset to the state because at no cost to the state are we able to do this. It's an area we'd like to expand on. We currently have a development coordinator to expand on scholarships. Again, it's a way we can get more funding to our students to get them on to higher education at no cost to the state.
Thanks. And that does include scholarships that might be geared towards particular populations, right? Students qualifying for different scholarships.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you for the question. It depends on the manner. For instance, scholarship that's dedicated to one specific institution, we do not handle that. But it could be very well for a specific program across a number of institutions. Yes, we could handle that. We do handle that.
Yeah, so. Thank you. And I think that's probably consistent with the kind of thing you're thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes.
Is this boilerplate language in here in regards to OSAC scholarship eligibility where it says the commission cannot award a scholarship to students who are enrolled in a course of study required for leading to a degree in theology, divinity, religious? My question would be, if I wanted to be a Mandarin major but a theology minor, would that eliminate me from consideration for this grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it depends on the institution, qualifying institution in the program. So it could, yes.
That's not a
Is that not a definitive answer? So, but that is boilerplate language. That is across all of our programs, including the Opportunity Grant.
So it depends on the institution and their emphasis, is that
correct?
Yes,
that's correct. If it's known as an institution dedicated to theology, then we do not work with that institution.
Hmm. Chair Denver, Representative Johnson, the Oregon Constitution specifically prohibits the use of public funds going to a religious or theological institution or body. So.
But we do have some of those courses offered in some of our public institutions as well. Right? I think we do.
Yes, I can address the programs at the institutions.
Okay. Okay, Representative Parker.
Thank you. do any organizations or individuals ever contribute shares of stock to be converted or to be held as funds for scholarships?
Is that an offer, Representative?
Definitely not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, thank you for the question. We normally bring donation sheets with us, allowing anyone who would like to donate for scholarships. So we do have manners that we can handle such a donation.
You have received shares of stocks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker.
I'm exploring something related to something else, okay?
Okay. Thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. I would like to do some research and get back to you on that question.
Okay,
so that I have very definitive answers for you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, thank you both for bringing this forth. And with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2221. Anna, what are we looking forward to on Tuesday?
Oh, lots of stuff. It's going to be so exciting.
Very good.
And don't be late.
No. You're not going to be here. But who's going to
on Tuesday? Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Tuesday, we are looking to have a report and informational meeting from some of the presidents of OUS. And then we will also be hearing from Eric Meslow, president of TimberCon. And in addition, we have House Bill 2963 on the agenda.
And Mr. Meslow is going to be talking to us about the ETIC program.
In relation to science and technology.
Correct.
And higher education.
And then textbooks.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, we hope you can all come back, and if not, watch us on TV. And with that, I'll close this today's hearing of the House Higher Ed Subcommittee.
Off to my next.